I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. Today's book is a little unusual for the show. It's not about cheese or meat or beer, but it's a phenomenal piece of history. It's called The President's Kitchen Cabinet, The Story of African Americans Who Have Fed Our First Families from the Washingtons to the Obamas. Thank you for joining me, the author, Adrian Miller.
Good to be with you.
Excellent. So, Adrian, you have an interesting history yourself. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about it? It's a combination of food and politics.
Yeah, I guess that's a nice way of saying I can't hold a job. But I'm a lawyer by training, and I practiced law for about 4 years, and then I went into politics. And my first job was at the top. So I worked in the Bill Clinton White House on something called the Initiative for One America. It was a racial reconciliation effort. And it had a wild and crazy idea that if we just talk to one another and listen, we might realize that we have a lot more in common than what supposedly divides us. Crazy. Then I transitioned to state politics in Colorado, and I did that for a little while, and now I'm the head of the Colorado Council of Churches, which is a religious social justice organization. So the common thread is I'm always looking for ways to bring people together and do social justice work and reconciliation work.
Okay. And what about your food history? You're also, you have another food book as well as this one?
Yeah. So the first book that I wrote was the book called Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. And it's a history of soul food. And I was lucky enough to win the James Beard Award for Outstanding Reference and Scholarship in 2014 for that
book. That's great.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how you came to this topic?
So it was actually while researching the soul food book. Unfortunately, while I was working in the White House, I never thought about the cooks. And I'm killing myself because I could have gotten so much scoop.
Oh, yeah. You would have had the inner roadway there.
Yeah. But while I was researching the soul food subject, as I was going through historical newspapers, these African Americans who have cooked for our presidents just kept popping up in the research. So when I finished that book, I said, you know what, if I can find enough stories, I'd like that to be my next one. And again, thanks to a lot of old newspapers, I was able to identify about 150 people who have cooked for our presidents from Washington to the Obamas.
That's the long list in the beginning of the book.
Yes.
That's entitled African American Presidential Culinary Professionals.
Yes, I did a broad term because I wanted to include everybody who was involved in food service, and roles have changed over time, so that's why I kind of did it that way instead of just saying cooks.
Okay, because there were some old-fashioned words that aren't really used anymore, I believe.
Right. So, for instance, the person who runs the entire White House domestic operations is now called the chief usher, instead of being called the steward. That was the term in the 19th century. And then kitchen workers were called scullions. Yeah, back then. And even the term White House executive chef didn't really exist until 1961 when First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy created it. Before that, they were just called first cook or head cook or chief cook.
Okay. Now, just back to you for a moment. How did you become a Kansas City certified barbecue society judge?
Well, I thought that barbecue would help me understand soul food better because so many soul food restaurants have a barbecue option and so many barbecue restaurants run by African Americans have soul food options on the menu, at least side dishes. So I went to the usually before a barbecue contest, they have a judge's class a couple days before. So I went in. Walked in, there was about 75 people, and I was the only dude under 250 pounds, so I knew that was my future. And, yeah, I learned more about barbecue, and it actually has helped add dimension to what I think about soul food, so much so that I think barbecue is going to be my next book.
Oh,
it was such a rich topic that I decided to delve into it separately.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds great. Now, how is it that there are so many African Americans in the White House kitchen?
Well, part of it, it's a several strands coming together. So the first thing is that for a lot of our presidents, African Americans were their cooks and private servants.
Already.
And so they played that role in private life. And a lot of people don't know this, but before Harry Truman, our presidents had to pay for a lot of the servants and food themselves out of their own pocket. So it saved money to bring somebody in, you know, who you've worked with before rather than hiring on the open labor market. And then quite a few were enslaved people because we've had several slaveholding presidents. But in the 19th and 18th and 19th centuries, as well into the 20th centuries, cooking was a role that was assumed natural for African Americans. And it was one of the few professions where African Americans could get a job, do well, and not suffer any white backlash. So it was just really kind of the way that our society viewed African Americans as servants that led to a lot of people being in the kitchen. And we have to understand that in the 1800s and early 1900s and so on, cooking was not the glamorous thing that it is now. It was seen as drudgery and menial work. So you know, you can't use the current lens to really look at how people felt about the kitchen back those days.
Right, but you talk a lot about the prestige of working in the White House compared with the low pay.
Yes. So that's a chronic gripe throughout the ages.
Though it must have been pretty cool to be in the White House even with low pay ever.
Yeah, for most people. There is one poignant example that I have in my book where there is an enslaved cook for President Tyler who somehow gets interviewed, and he points out that he'd rather be free than the prestige. But, yeah, over time, that's for most people who choose to be there, yeah, that is definitely the trade-off.
Right.
Because, you know, you're in a historic home. You're cooking for one of the most powerful people in the world. And, you know, if you have pride in your work, you want to do well.
And you're hearing about things at the dinner table that must be pretty exciting.
Yes. Unfortunately, there's this code of silence.
They wouldn't talk to you.
Get to hear a lot of that stuff. But fortunately, there have been a couple of White House servants who wrote tell-all books. And we get some really, really good nuggets of information there. After they wrote their books, that's when the White House started having a non-disclosure agreement. Among the workers.
So I'm just wondering an odd question: who pays the for the food in Mar-a-Lago?
Oh, that's interesting. So, you know, we don't get a lot of information about the current administration,
right?
But Congress does a lot, an amount of money for White House food, for presidential food. So what happens is, as purchases are made, they are billed against that account.
And is it a reasonable amount of money now?
Oh, yeah. I don't know the round figure because those, you know, you have to actually add together accounts from different agencies because a lot of the money is moved around, so we don't know exactly how much is spent.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a decent amount of money. It's it's an amount where they shouldn't, you know, run out unless they're having a lot of extravagance.
Okay, because you talk a lot in the book about different economies and some presidents being cheap and some head cooks being cheap and some wanting to spend. So it just never occurred to me to think of the White House having any sort of a budget. It's so, you know, it's so fancy.
Right. And you would just think, hey, the president can get whatever he or she wants whenever they want.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
That's not the reality.
Okay. So where did you find all this information? Where did you do your research?
So I did go to many of our presidential libraries.
That's what I was guessing.
And it was really hit or miss in terms of what the presidential libraries had. If the archivists at the time didn't think that the White House kitchen was important, you really just don't get much.
Okay.
Same with the White House photographer. But there are
so it just depends on who found what interesting and what they brought into the library.
Right. And there are some libraries that have been very good about telling the food story. Like I would say the Carter Library, Jimmy Carter Library. For the most part, they've kept the residents' menus of what he ate.
Wow.
So if he was in town and you pick a date, you can pretty much find out what he had for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. And sometimes you get marginal notes from Rosalind Carter basically saying, oh, Jimmy doesn't like this or that.
That's great. Now, this is all mostly pre-internet research you're doing.
Correct. So you have to get in the archive.
Yeah,
and
so it was old-fashioned.
But the real boon for my research was digitized historical newspapers from the Library of Congress and a few private companies. Because these newspapers are word searchable. So once you figure out how the kitchen was discussed in those times, and the White House workers, then you get a lot of information.
Okay. Now, one thing I was thinking about was the difference between the public persona of the president and the private reality. And, you know, the trustworthy professionals really know the families on a day-to-day basis. But you say they didn't talk that much.
No, because one of the fastest ways out of the White House was to be someone who had loose lips.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there was a pride among the servants and the cooks to maintain that confidentiality. Because in many instances, we see a deep affection between the president and the people on the resident staff.
Well, that's what you also, your book tells a lot of very nice stories about very good relationships. Which one is your favorite?
My favorite is the one between, and I know it was a contentious relationship at times, but the one between Lyndon Johnson and Zephyr Wright, who was the longtime cook for Lyndon Johnson before he even went into politics.
Can you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. So she gets hired. She's from Marshall, Texas. She gets hired in the 1940s. She moves with the family to Washington as Lyndon Johnson starts his rise in politics. And back in those days, members of Congress would have other members of Congress over for dinner. Can you believe that? And they were a lot of people attribute Lyndon Johnson's rise to the dinners, the amazing dinners that Zephyr Wright would make. And he got a chance for him to meet people, and you know, those relationships paid off later in his political career. But when he becomes president, he actually has Zephyr Wright sit in the family box with other members of the family. And a really interesting story is that he used her Jim Crow experiences in the Deep South to persuade members of Congress to support the 1964 Civil Rights Bill.
Excellent.
And when he signs that bill, he gives her one of the pens and says, you deserve this as much as anyone.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's
isn't that a great story?
Yeah, that is nice. And did she appreciate the, you know, heaviness of that?
Well, when you read her oral history, she kind of shrugs it off. And I don't know if that was just the mood she was in that day, but she was more kind of, I'm going to keep my head down and do my job.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell the Zingerman story, which led to your book?
Yes. So I first talked to Ari Weinzweig about doing an event at Zingerman's Roadhouse in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And they have an annual African-American dinner. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was going to do something on soul food, and he happened to pick the day that President Obama was being inaugurated. And I said, you know, I've just found all of these interesting stories about African Americans who have cooked for our presidents. Maybe we could do a program on that. Mm-hmm. And he agreed, and that's where I told my first stories about presidents, and it went really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me the encouragement to really pursue doing a fuller book on the subject.
Oh, that's neat. That's neat. We've had Ari on the show. And
okay. He's
he writes books on business.
Yes.
So everybody's got a different sideline.
Right.
Now, many presidents, you say, I mean, so many things in the book I did not realize. You talk about many of them were wealthy people with personal cooks. I almost felt like the book is describing a Downton Abbey environment because that's one of the only times I've seen, you know, the downstairs cooking and kitchen and whole big life and the upstairs rich people eating.
Right.
And wasn't the kitchen downstairs, or did they sleep downstairs, or?
Yes. So the kitchen is in the basement of the White House.
Mm-hmm. Still? Still?
Yeah, still.
Okay.
So it starts out, it's changed locations, but it's always been in the basement. This is mm-hmm. the main White House kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the early days, especially the enslaved cooks actually slept down their headquarters right off the main kitchen. So their world was in that basement.
Mm-hmm.
And the White House kitchen, that basement was not a pleasant place because, as you know, the White House is built in a reclaimed swamp area.
Mm-hmm.
And people were getting tropical diseases in the 1800s. The White House basement would occasionally flood after really good rain. There was a lot of infestations at times of different critters. So, yeah, it was a challenging place to work.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, additional cooking spaces get added in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
After the 1952 renovation by President Truman,
mm-hmm.
a White House mess, which is a Navy term for kind of a dining area, it's a nice clubby dining area for senior staff for the president,
mm-hmm.
Gets added.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now staffed by Navy cooks.
Okay.
And then
now, was that where you could have eaten when you were there?
I could have once I got it to a certain position.
And did you?
I did.
Okay, good.
And let me tell you, the cheeseburger there is glorious.
I don't know what it's
like now, but when I was there, it was glorious.
Now, and is it known to have other good food?
Yes, they rotate the menu.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so I think different administrations are known for different things. I think George W. Bush was known to have like a Taco Thursday or something like that. So they each take on their own vibe.
Okay.
But one other thing I just wanted to mention is in 1961, Jacqueline Kennedy turns Margaret Truman's old bedroom into a space with a pantry and a kitchen so that the family could now eat on the second floor.
Because
they used to eat downstairs in one of the bigger rooms, and she just felt that wasn't intimate enough for the family.
Mm-hmm. And is that the kitchen that they can go in by themselves and get food, or is that another addition?
It's another addition. So in terms of the food, usually there's a little elevator that's
mm-hmm.
brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just ask the servants what they need, and then that gets sent up to the, mm-hmm. the stairs to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, until the accessibility of the Obamas, I never thought about what the president was eating.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what about with the state dinners? Were you just curious about
that? State dinners, yes, yes. But
okay. That's
a completely different arm, right?
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with what you're talking about.
Not so much. I mean, certainly African Americans have helped with presenting the state dinners, but
mm-hmm.
I really wanted to tell the story of home cooking
mm-hmm.
in the White House.
Right, right.
Where the African American presence was much more pronounced.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it separate because they don't need the state dinners are unusual, so don't they just hire occasional people for that, or is there a whole staff?
Oh, yeah, so it depends on the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
But in much of the 1800s, let me say, before 1850, the White House cook often did everything. So even the state dinners. But the state dinners were just for 36 people back then because
okay.
it was a lot of hearth cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some rudimentary stoves and things that they used. By the time you get to the latter part of the 1800s, there was a trend of hiring French chefs from outside the White House to cater the state
mm-hmm.
dinners. When you get to President Taft, they switched that and then had everything done in-house. Mm-hmm. So once again, you have the White House cooks doing everything.
Okay.
And it's pretty much been that case ever since. There may be a guest chef every once in a while, but the same staff is cooking the state dinners. And then depending on the size of the state dinner, they will hire additional staff to get everything done. Because the White House kitchen is quite small.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take a break. First, I want to just announce to our listeners that, as you may know, this show is only possible thanks to member donations, and we would literally not be able to reach you every week without the generosity of HRN members around the world. It's our summer membership drive. I hope you'll join. I'll hope you rejoin. And you can find us on heritageradionetwork.org/donate right now. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer. And we'll be back soon.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirsois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com. And as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Hi, I'm Linda Liu, host of Feast Meets West on Heritage Radio Network. Feast Meets West traces the stories of your favorite Asian foods, from their origins to what they mean in today's food culture. Tune in on Wednesdays, 8 p.m. to hear my co-host Iris and I interview chefs, restaurateurs, and other food experts about Asian cuisine. Support my show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to become a member today.
Hi, Diane Stemple back talking to Adrian Miller, who wrote The President's Kitchen Cabinet, which details the history of African Americans in the White House kitchen. Adrian, I'm wondering, another thing I didn't realize is how you talk about the District of Columbia being so Southern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so even today, well, D.C.'s changing quite a bit now, but even during my time there in the 90s, it did have a Southern feel to it, especially on the weekends. But D.C. is carved out of two Southern states, two slaving states, actually. And it's interesting in its history because there was slavery within the district. You could walk down the street. There could be slave auctions. There was actually a slave pen right where the site of the current U.S. Capitol building.
Mm-hmm.
Enslaved African Americans built a lot of the buildings, including the White House.
Mm-hmm.
There would be slave coffles going through the streets. So the visitors to D.C., especially foreign visitors, noted kind of the presence of enslaved Africans and African Americans in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that part of the culture, but a lot, if you look at the newspapers, the restaurant scene and other thing, it was default Southern cuisine.
But you also talk about how there were more freed slaves in D.C. at a certain point than there were slaves.
Yes, because a lot of the surrounding slave states, once a enslaved person was freed or manumitted, they didn't want that person hanging around in the state.
They had to leave.
Inspiration. Yeah.
Okay.
to others. So they were actually forced to leave. And so D.C. became a natural mecca for a lot of free people to come and start businesses and try to, you know, make something of their lives.
Right. I read some of the nicknames. They called it Negra Mecca or Chocolate City.
Yes.
I didn't, you know, these are things you don't know.
Yeah.
Until you read your book. Wow. So what's the connection between Jefferson's chef Hemmings and Sally Hemmings, Jefferson's mistress?
So Sally Hemmings was James Hemmings' younger sister.
Okay.
So Sally Hemmings had two older brothers. And so James is the second oldest brother. The strong connection they have is when Jefferson becomes minister to France, he actually brings James Hemmings over first and has him trained as a classical French chef. Spends a lot of money to make that happen.
Now, is that because he has ulterior motives, or is that because he's being nice to Hemmings' brother, or why?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure. I just think he just had a need for a chef.
Okay.
And didn't want to pay somebody the prevailing wage.
Okay, probably. So he took a slave.
Yeah. So he was thinking the long run, right? He's
okay.
Like, well, I've got this young man here who I own. I'm going to have him trained as a chef because not only will he cook for me here, but he'll cook for me back in Virginia.
But isn't life in Paris learning how to be a chef a pretty unique experience for anyone, much less a slave?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I would love to have learned more about James Hemmings' life in his own words.
Yeah.
Because all we have really are just kind of Jefferson's spotty observations on the matter. And then so Sally Hemmings, as a young woman, comes with one of Jefferson's daughters over to France. And many believe that that's where the sexual relationship begins. The interesting thing is, while both of the Hemmings are over in France, France had something, I think it's called the Freedom Principle, where if a third party advocated on their behalf, they could actually be freed because they were on French soil and enslaved. But what Jefferson does is he starts paying both of them a wage similar to what other servants got
in France.
In Paris at that time.
Okay. So But they knew they were still slaves, or did they?
Yeah, they knew that.
So but he was doing that.
Happened where they stayed under his employ. But he was paying them, so it was a very complex situation. Now, the interesting thing that happens when they return to the United States is that Hemmings actually approaches Jefferson and asks to be freed, and Jefferson agrees. On two conditions: that one, that Hemmings teaches other enslaved people at Monticello how to cook, and you know, because Jefferson had spent all this money having him trained,
right?
And that two, that he would leave behind his recipes.
And did he agree?
He did do that, and Jefferson freed him in 1796.
Okay. So he used it. He used his training to get his freedom.
He did.
Okay.
Now, he does eventually come back to Monticello for a short period of time to cook. And most certainly, if he ends up drinking himself to death before Jefferson becomes president. But I guarantee that if they had a friendly relationship, Hemmings would have been the White House chef. I'm convinced of that. Had he been stayed alive.
Now, let's talk about cheese a little bit. What is the history of macaroni and cheese in the White House?
So we know that at least the earliest recording we have of macaroni and cheese in the White House is under Jefferson. On February 6, 1802, Jefferson serves it at a dinner party attended by a guy named Manasseh Cutler, who was a congressman from Massachusetts. And he did not know what to make of macaroni and cheese. It was a new thing to him. He thought the macaroni noodles were onions. Yeah, and he said it was strong and had a disagreeable taste.
Oh, he didn't like it.
Nah, he didn't.
Too bad.
But he didn't understand what the dish was, so he asked the guy sitting next to him what it was, and that guy was Meriwether Lewis of the Lewis and Clark Expedition.
And he knew?
Explained the dish to him, yeah.
Okay. And what about Daisy Bonner souffle?
Yeah. Cheese souffle. I'm sorry. One more thing about that. Okay. So after that macaroni, that dinner where macaroni and cheese was served, the dinner party went to the East Room to look at the big block of cheese that Jefferson received as a gift from some farmers.
Oh, right. And it was gigantic.
It was gigantic. So that was entertainment, was to go look at a big cheese. Now, in terms of the cheese souffle, on FDR's last day of life in Warm Springs, Georgia, and Warm Springs, Georgia had a mineral hot springs where Roosevelt would go to get treatments for his polio. And when he when they go there, he's sitting for a painting, and Daisy Bonner had decided to make a cheese souffle that was going to be served to him at 1:15 p.m. The cheese souffle, but FDR has a fatal cerebral hemorrhage at 1:12.
Okay.
So he never gets to eat the souffle. But according to Daisy Bonner, and this is a miracle if for anybody who's made a souffle.
Okay.
That souffle did not fall for 2 hours until he was officially pronounced dead.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing.
Yeah. But you find that hard to believe, don't you?
Well, you know, I think someone could have made it up.
Yeah.
But it's a nice idea. It's a nice idea. Now, your book is so full of little interesting facts. I had never heard of a lesser pea.
Right. Oh.
Now, maybe other people have. A lesser pea is apparently a recipe that purposely leaves out important ingredients.
Yeah, so you may not have heard of one, but I'm sure you've received one.
Oh.
if you've ever asked anybody for a recipe.
Yes, I keep cooking them.
Right. So, yeah, you know, there's some cooks that they just really don't want anybody to get the true recipe for something because I don't know if they think somebody's going to steal their thunder by making the dish as well as they do. And, you know, my plea to cooks is just have some confidence.
Right, and, that you're doing it better. You're doing it better, and probably not the same people are going to be eating the recipe the second time.
Right. And cooks, I think, bring something to a recipe, you know. They put their own spin on it or whatever.
Right. Well, every time you make something, it's different anyway.
Yeah. And so, so cooks were known for just leaving things out. And Zephyr Wright was an example of a cook who would, if anybody would ask for a recipe, she would leave one or two things out on purpose. And then leave you to figure it out.
Okay. And so that's called a lesser P. L-E-S-S-E-R-P-E.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I love that your last recipe of the book comes from a young woman who won a seat at Michelle Obama's Kid State Dinner with her recipe. It looks pretty long and complicated. And you have a picture of that young woman. I think it's the last picture in the book, and she's adorable.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know if a lot of people know about this, but starting in about 2012, I believe, Michelle Obama would have healthy eating or cooking competitions, and she would invite people from every state to submit a recipe, kids. And the winning recipe, whoever won, would get to go to the White House for what she called a kids' state dinner.
So one person from every state.
Yes, had a winning recipe. And these recipes are actually compiled every year, and they're available online. And so Kiana Farkish is the woman to whom you're referring, the young woman to whom you're referring. She represented Colorado in 2014, and so I was fortunate enough to connect with her and include her in the book. Because the reason I did that is I wanted to see to what extent the White House inspires young people today. Do they think about it? You know, is it, you know, I just wanted to see what was going on.
Well, but I think that Michelle Obama's mission was centered on healthy food, child obesity. You know, she really focused for 8 years on those issues. So I think she probably inspired and brought in a lot of children's interest.
Yes, I think so. And I can tell you that Ms. Farkish is on fire for food justice issues. And she's very bright.
She could be president
herself.
How old is
she now? Yeah.
How old is she now?
So she, let's see, no, she's probably 11 now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because that was a little while ago, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the story of your friend, the sad story about Walter? How do you pronounce his last name?
Scheib.
Now, he was another White House chef?
Yes, he's not African-American, though, but he was the White House executive chef
mm-hmm.
for Bill Clinton, both terms, and uh-huh. then the first term of George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped you
with your book.
Yeah, he did. So I was just in the initial stages of my research, and I called him, and I emailed him, and he emailed and said, hey, feel free to call me.
Mm-hmm.
I called him, and we just talked for a long time, and he immediately understood what I was trying to do and the importance of the work.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a great resource. He could help answer a lot of kind of technical questions
mm-hmm.
and things you just never hear about the White House food operations.
Mm-hmm.
And we were planning on doing a film documentary on this subject, and he tragically died while solo hiking in the mountains outside of Taos, New Mexico.
Oh, that is such a shame.
Yeah, so I really do miss his counsel, and that's mm-hmm. why I dedicated the book in part to him,
mm-hmm.
Just
mm-hmm.
because of what he meant to me in my research.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's nice. That's nice.
Yeah.
So you also you wanted to talk about the future of the White House cooks. What are you thinking now?
Well, one thing is, could there ever be another African American who runs the White House kitchen? And
mm-hmm.
the answer is yes,
mm-hmm.
because any president can pick whomever they want
mm-hmm. Right.
for that job. A lot of working in the White House kitchen means being in the right place at the right time and in the right point in your career.
Yeah. It seemed like even with your stories, sometimes these people whose in-depth stories you had just fell into it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, no, most definitely.
Yeah.
Most of the White House cooks have been accidental.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I can't think of anybody who started their career saying, I want to be a White House chef.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may not be the case any longer,
right.
Given the rise of celebrity chef culture and other
mm-hmm.
things and how much the Obamas have really raised the profile of White House food.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody may actually say, I want to be White House chef at one point. But again,
and go for it. Make a concerted effort. Well, did you have the story about Samuelson who was he offered the opportunity to just cook a state dinner or did he turn down White House chef?
So Marcus Samuelson, who's well known on the Food Network and
mm-hmm.
is a chef now in Harlem,
mm-hmm.
a very interesting story, born in Ethiopia and then adopted by Swedish parents.
Mm-hmm.
He was offered the opportunity to cook the first state dinner for the Obamas.
Ah.
The person who you're thinking about who turned down the job was a man named Patrick Clark.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah, he was a well-known New York chef.
And he
Ooh.
Was sort of,
yeah.
he would have lost a lot of money if he took it.
Right, would have been a serious salary cut, and he had several kids.
Right,
that he
right.
was, you know, he had a large family.
And I think the salary cut could have been $400,000.
I think he was definitely in the six figures. So I think he was making like $200,000 at the time.
Oh, okay.
And the White
mm-hmm.
House salary at the White House chef salary at that time was $58,000.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like it's an easy job.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
no, it's
I mean,
not.
It's not like you get to go to bed early, like. You know,
yeah.
Exactly. I mean, maybe earlier than a restaurant, but if things are hopping, you've got to hop.
mm-hmm.
Anyway, well, thank you so much. You know, American Cheese Society is coming to Denver. Are you going to be able to visit with the ACS?
Well, if you all will let me show my face around there, I hope so.
It's a very fun conference. There's a lot of great seminars, and your book will be in the bookstore, you said, right?
Yes, I do think they plan to sell my book.
And there's a festival of cheese. I don't know if you like cheese, but there's a festival of cheese on our last night that is, you know, has, you know, 600 cheeses cut up to taste.
Oh, nice. All right.
And then the 400 fresh cheeses go in the morning or something. You know, I don't know what the breakdown is, but there's lots of cheese.
So will there be mac and cheese and cheese souffle, maybe?
Oh, now that's an interesting question. There isn't that much cooked cheese at the Festival of Cheese, though sometimes on the outer edges of the room, some people cook things.
Okay.
But we'll have to, we're not that crazily into mac and cheese at the ACF's meeting because we eat so much uncooked cheese, you can't start eating it cooked as well.
Gotcha. Okay.
Anyway, okay, well, thank you very much. This is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. Adrian Miller's book is called The President's Kitchen Cabinet, and I recommend it to any history buff or African-American history buff, or it's a very interesting book. Thank you, Adrian, for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
For listening.